contact with Yes in that role. We know him, of course, for his various parade leaderships and bus departure greetings, as well as his famous matins. Shot in one of the, I believe this is probably a Renaissance Fair outfit. Once Holden Village Incorporated was formed, one of the key early figures was Gil Burke. His pith helmet here says Holden Village Mayor, and that was sort of his title, 61, 62. Very instrumental in organizing, overseeing the refurbishing of the village, the cleaning up of the messy days of the ghost town, and organizing volunteers to come in and do that cleanup work, but also a lot of outside organizing in terms of fundraising, securing diesel generators so that there would be electricity, securing some vehicles so that there were some ways to get people up and down. So a lot of that essential early organizing happened under Gilbert's leadership. His partner in that activity was Wilton Bergstrand. And he was one of the leaders of the in the Lutheran Church youth movements, and eventually went back to that work full-time as the LCA got up and running. The sort of the start of Holden Village coincided with the formation of the Lutheran Church in America, and he became more involved in that leadership and had to decline the chance to work for Holden full-time. But he and Bergstrand worked, or he and Berg worked together. In fact, they were known as Berg and Bergie. And they were the leadership combination in 61 and 62 that got this place up and running. Bergstrand, particularly in fundraising, in establishing relationships with church leadership around the country. The early years of Holden were marked by this sort of strong connection with all the youth organizations of the various Lutheran bodies at that time. And that was the initial vision of Holden, that it would be a retreat center for young adults, for post-high school young adult type things. And the, all the churches jumped in with their youth councils around that. And so the early organizers, the man on the left is Merton Strawman, who was also one of the early national body Lutheran youth leaders, but also instrumental in the early Holden board and part of the support group for getting Holden organized in those early years.
No jacuzzi.
No jacuzzi there.
None of the other
guys? Frank Gamlin. Vern Rieke in the center here was involved in the, as a leader in the board, also in the legal parts of getting the Holden Village Incorporated up and running. And he was the board president from the early 60s through 77, I think.
Is that Leo Bustad?
Leo Bustad with him on the left was an early teaching staff feature. And then in 63, Carol Hinderly was called as the executive director of Holden Village.
She was 63?
63. Mm-hmm. And he served in that role from 1963 to 1976, so 13 years as director with his wife, Mary Hinderly. And it's really the two of them together that in many ways formed the essential character of the Holden we know now as an adult family-oriented retreat center. They had worked with retreat center ministries in Europe and brought with them a vision of what a retreat center could mean for the American church, particularly the American Lutheran church. And so it's really their indelible stamp on the village that sort of shaped the rhythm of the summers and the kind of programming and the kinds of themes that I think are taken up in the village. Carol here with Daryl Lumbee, one of his early worship assistants. Werner Jensen was brought in also in 1963 to become the business manager for Holden here with his wife. And he served in that role through the Hinderly years and the Schramm years, 17 years, I think, in that role as business manager.
Was that when Chalet 2 was still standing?
Mm-hmm.
That's not 2 in the background.
No.
But besides overseeing the physical facilities, he was very much involved in program and the programmatic life of the village.
He was Cranmer in Man for All Seasons.
In his role, it was a simpler time and fewer regulations, but he functioned as business manager, as operations manager, as staff coordinator. So there are about 7 or 8 people now that do his job in more complicated times. Yeah. But he was that for the village for many years.
And didn't he lead, did you say he led intercessory prayer at noon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was that?
He led prayer out at the picnic table under the big tree outside the dining hall every day at noon.
Yeah, that was intercessory prayer.
Yeah. Al Daring on the left was part of the early fundraising crew, working with Carol in that capacity. Carol Hinderly and Mary were out of the village in the wintertime, and they spent a lot of their early years sort of beating the bushes in rural Minnesota and rural Iowa and the Midwest, drumming up financial support, and Al was part of that team. John Mockestead on the right was one of the teaching staff in those years. And Carol and Mary assembled a cadre of regular teaching staff through the 60s and early 70s. And we won't be able to show all of them, but I thought I'd flash a few photos of some of those regulars in those years. Howard Hong from St. Olaf College. Norm Hobble. Conrad Bergendorf. Will Hirschfeld. Roland Baton was part of a group of, shall we say, better known theologians to be brought through as part of the teaching staff.
I think we have curtains like that lady's skirt.
It's usually still the other way around. Curtains on purpose.
Paul Mons was regularly part of the musical staff. Of course, wow. Beanie Lundholm here with Gertrude.
Oh, she's beautiful. Wow.
Look at that, Gertrude.
Beanie was here summer after summer organizing the music for worship and particularly musical vespers and the early morning carillon. And of course, the Beanie sings, and that became part of the regular feature of the meals.
When we could no longer dance around the hotel dining room, that was a real, Those circle dances were just so much fun.
Through the floor.
How is that situated? I can't.
It's in there backwards, I'm afraid.
Oh, okay.
But the. Her brokering was another well-known regular teaching staff person. Yes, that is Jean with him there. Huh. We'll have another picture of her a little bit later.
Jean Spider?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
On the left.
Spider.
And of course, Rudy was involved from the early 60s on, and part of his mission was to preserve the historical documents of the mine and ultimately create a museum, which he did in several places around the village through the early years, from up on the third level to down here in Koinonia and a few other spots around the village. Always dreaming someday of a permanent facility, which eventually came to fruition in 1983. Best known perhaps for his mine hikes. His wife Doris, here with Phil Brunel, part of this key songwriting team for the Beanie Songs, but Doris was also very much involved in establishing the program for children, which became Narnia. And that was the Narnia building kind of became that space for kids in 1966, approximately. That was the time that finally this Koinonia addition was, or remodeling was finished, creating meeting space finally for the
sessions. But Carol was already announcing it in 63. He was coming around saying, we've got this, we've got this, we've got this. When we came up in 63, we said, oh, it wasn't quite what he had said.
Now, Doris had been involved in innovative
she was a good teacher.
Education stuff back in Illinois and brought those skills to bear in helping to establish Narnia. She worked with Jean Swihart in that process. Jean was active with the Narnia program, but also on the teaching staff. Her husband, Al Swihart, took on a lot of the early gardening efforts, especially getting trees planted around the village, and many of the tall, mature trees that we see in places around the Chalet Circle and other spots around were things that he planted and nurtured in those early years. There were a lot of other regulars on staff, as well as the regular teaching staff. Tossed in this picture of Terry Saturn, who was instrumental in a lot of the early physical facilities, especially the hydro and the diversion dam, getting a lot of rewiring done around the village, getting heaters installed in rooms and radiators taken out of rooms, and a lot of those necessary physical things. We also attribute to Terry the statue dancing servant, which became an important symbol for the volunteer staff. Oh, sorry about that.
Where is this statue now?
It's at the base of the lectern in the Village Center worship space. So it's still
right next to a bouquet of flowers.
Are all these slides labeled?
Yes.
Good.
And there are many more where they came from.
Oh, that's not a good sound.
I'm sorry.
I can do it.
Do you want me to back it up, Rick?
Does someone have a coin?
Do you have a bucket then?
Oh, I got it.
Keys, there it is.
We don't carry money. Did you notice in those early pictures the women are all carrying purses around?
And the men are wearing suits and ties.
Yeah.
And the women are wearing pearls. And their little basic black dresses.
It must have been Sunday worship. They really dressed up.
Yeah. High heels.
Did they have high heels on?
Yeah. And that beautiful side of Gertrude, she was wearing high heels.
Yeah, she looks pretty shabby. Very wow.
When Carol left in 76, the board named Fritz Norstedt on the right as the interim director, here with Werner and Leo Bustad down at Dobkey Lake. Fritz had been involved from the very first in helping get the village established, had been a regular on the teaching staff during Carol's years here. And they were good friends and St. Olaf classmates together, so it was a natural choice to take on that role of interim director, although that was a hard year and a difficult transition with the departure of Carol. In 78, then John Schramm and his wife Mary, it's a little dark, became directors and brought with them a different vision of some of the priorities in the village, particularly a strong emphasis on peace and social justice issues and nonviolence and a variety of other concerns that stemmed out of that awareness. Jim Fish served in part as village pastor, but also took on he and his wife Kay took on the role of staff coordinators, sort of the first of Werner's jobs to split off into a separate role. So in the late 70s, they were staff coordinators. Walt Bowman was the first of the summer teaching staff coordinators, and a number of other people have taken turns at that role in the years since, but prior to that, the teaching staff had been arranged by especially Mary Hinderly, but Carol and Mary together. I couldn't find pictures of at least slide photos of all the cooks. Dave Christian was head cook during a big chunk of those Schramm years. But we had a long line of head cooks prior to that, and David was responsible for putting together the cookbook Cook Boldly, which is in its third or fourth edition revision now. Fifth now?
He's what?
He authored the cookbook, and he was the head cook.
He's alive now?
Oh, yeah. He's now the chair of the Holden Board.
Okay. I thought he said he's dead now.
No. Paul Bowe was the interim director. Oh, this is out of order, though, because he was interim director after Elmer. And I had meant to switch these around. I knew they were in the wrong order, but Paul and his wife Carola, he served as interim director after Elmer Witt. So that Elmer was the director after John and Mary, here with his wife Jenny and a friend. But Elmer was another one who was involved in the village right from the very start through his youth leadership in the Walther League, the Missouri Synod Youth Organization. Elmer had been part of the teaching staff, part of the board through the Hinderly years, and so brought a long experience with the village to the director position. His wife Jenny unfortunately died right before he began his leadership as director.
Just an update on Elmer. Elmer had a stroke, as some of you may have heard, in Europe a couple of months ago. And he's coming along well, home and in rehab and recovering really very, very well.
Yeah. And he's been up to the village since then. So.
Since that time?
Yeah, he's been up this summer. So.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. He used to play Elmer's tune all the time.
So here's Elmer with one of his village pastors during his years, Barbara Rossi.
And the guy on the left, who was an electrician, Bob Edwards, is now a pastor, too. And Margaret Penning is the bookstore manager. So, right
there. So between Elmer and Scott should have been the Paul Bull picture, but then Scott Hauser took over as executive director after Elmer. So that probably took a little longer than we originally intended, but it's a quick look at some faces that have been important in helping to shape this place, shape the essential character of the place.
I wonder if we could have some of those shades beginning? Open now, so we can have more light.
Yeah. Did you show Wilbur Berg and...
You did.
I knew him quite well years ago.
Can you say some things about Wilbur?
Decent man.
Whether we could start with a couple of stories about Carol and Mary Hinderly, since they were early and key, and a plant I think I have for that would be Janet or Barb. Either one of you could.
Well, I first came here in 1973, so others of you know more earlier stuff, but I would say just what Rick said, that Carol was really responsible for putting the idea of Holden as a place of excellent program together. And it really shaped me and many others, I mean thousands of young people, to be working and learning at the same time. I came up here during college for a number of summers. I was a waitress. And he was just so exciting in his teaching on Ephesians and Galatians, especially. We'd sit there reading Luther's commentary on Galatians. But he brought this vision of work and study as a kind of integrated life, and the hilarity. I think that's when slogans like Holy Hilarity came in. He was really focused on Paul's epistle to the Galatians, where Jesus trades places with us almost, and for a while there, Holden had this boat. It was probably a mistake, but anyway, and the name of the boat was the Happy Exchange, named after that idea in Galatians. Mary was sick a lot. She had asthma, and I wish that she could have come back to Holden after the tailings got covered, because we've had some windy days recently, and in those days, the dust from the tailings, the orange dust, would have been blowing in the air, and Mary wouldn't have been able to go out of her house. She used a mask sometimes even, but she's the one who started the Holden bookstore and is an absolute delight. It's still alive in Stockholm, Wisconsin. Carol just died a few years ago, and that was a big and kind of wonderful funeral. Paul Hinderly, his son, was head cook for a lot of those years, and then now runs a restaurant. It was just really exciting to be around them. The kind of exuberance of Holden was a gift they brought that's really shaped me and a lot of others.
He was at it all day long. You just seen him start out in the morning, and when he stopped, he sat on his porch, and then people came and talked to him. It was just constant. I think he was coming out to. In 62, I know in 63, I saw him a couple of times, and he would be, he was just a very enthusiastic person and just passed that enthusiasm on.
Was he the one that has set the pattern for bringing all ideas and opening all kinds of ideas to us? You would give him credit? Is that, do you feel him? That no topic is taboo, no topic is not worth talking about.
But he'd argue if he didn't agree. But he'd argue if he didn't agree.
Okay. No. But he allowed, and did he encourage it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I remember talking to him. The first time I was up here, it was 1963, And I remember him telling me that he was in Norway when the Germans occupied Norway. And he managed to get the heck out of there and back in the United States. And I can't...
Carol? I think he was in Japan.
He wound up being 4 years in a POW camp.
Yeah. Japanese.
But he was in Norway, too.
Yeah, he had been in Norway when the...
When the Germans came to
us. Oh, I didn't realize that.
Could have been in the 30s.
Escaped and then went...
Well, that would be 39 or so. And...
And then went to China.
Went as a missionary. And then was captured by the Japanese.
Can anybody comment on how Holden sort of moved during that time from being a youth camp to being an adult camp? How did that, under whose leadership, and what was that all about? Wasn't it...
A little bit of a rugged transition, I think. As I say, the early leadership was all youth-oriented, and Carol came in with a different vision of a more of an adult-oriented center for training laity. I mean, I think they brought a vision of an educated, trained laity to the church that would revitalize the congregations. And through the early 60s, there was a lot of overlap between those two visions. Mm-hmm. And I think it was pretty apparent that Carol and Gil Berg, for example, weren't going to work together the same way Berg and Bergstrand had worked together. And there were youth-oriented activities, and it really took to about 1970 before the whole Holden summer was what we see now. I mean, there were other groups that came in and used it in the early years, a lot of youth-oriented activities through those early years, but it took Carol a number of years to finally get his vision for the place, really.
I get the impression, because Carol had been in a prison of war camp, that he knew what it was to impoverish your mind spiritually, and when he came here, he wanted to expand your mind, and so I remember the Holden hilarity was really Holden hilarity when he was here, which I don't see as much now, because he was so much to enjoy.
Celebrate life,
yeah. Celebrate the grace in the Lutheran faith. And we would have baseball games frequently. There were plays, I don't know how many times, and there was just a lot more of all the...
Well, just the beanie sings made a big difference, because there was not the rush from one meal to the other.
That's right.
Always that time to sit and sing and sometimes dance, and it created community in a way that we don't have it now.
That's right.
And Mary Hinderly loved Christmas, and she would do readings. We'd come up here July 25th, you know, we celebrate Christmas. On July 25th, we have Christmas trees and the crafts. We'd make Christmas decorations and so forth. The whole village was celebrated in anticipation of that week, a couple weeks previous, in anticipation of July 25th for Christmas. And she would read. And one year, I wasn't at the session, but my husband went to her readings of Christmas stories, and she read the best Christmas pageant ever, like the first few pages or chapter or something. And that Christmas, Alarmin, my husband, had bought the book. And we sat down as a family on Christmas Day, and he was just saying, well, you really should read the book. And I said, well, why don't you read the first chapter? And so he read the first chapter, and I looked at the size of the book, and it's just a very short book. I said, well, looked at my watch, we can do this. And we started reading the best Christmas pageant out loud. We just took turns in our family, each reading a chapter. This was 6 years ago? We still do it.
Let's add a layer. Let's add Gilbert.
I want to add something in there. You were saying something about changing from youth to adult. Mm-hmm. There was one time, a couple of years that we were here, youth camps, high school groups coming in was a real regular, and they would stay in Lodge 4. And that was essentially being destroyed in the process. And I think there was a very strong feeling about that time that they were stop having that kind of program and focus more on adults and families.
The building was being destroyed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
kids can be wet.
Part of it was the money. I remember when I started coming, they already, I mean, the money situation was a little bitter, but they really needed money, and so they would sometimes rent out a lodge to the Air Force, some group that came in from the Air Force. I have no idea why and stuff. So I think that some of the problem was financial.
There was also a strongly conservative evangelical group that...
Yes, that's right.
Camp Farthest Out.
Camp Farthest Out, that's right.
That's what they referred to it, and that it had several summers of that renting out space to have their retreats.
I would like to add Gilbert, just if I figure if we keep layering on people, we don't have to stop talking about any one person, but the stories can expand and we'll focus, change the focus a little and continue on. Because we don't have a lot of time and we have so many people to talk about. It's frustrating. So maybe, is there any additional word you would like want to say, Rick, about Gilbert? Or should we say it in the slide?
Something you want to say?
No, I've known him a long, long time, but not that personal. He was a member of the Lutheran Free Church, I know that.
Gilbert went on to do some other amazing things. LBI, Seattle LBI, was really on the brink of bankruptcy, and he offered a substantial donation that it was matched, that LBI received this gift, and he gave that gift and it was matched, and LBI is now much more solvent. And I don't want to, well, it was $1 million that he offered to LBI.
But he was a very important part of the financial management of this and getting this organized financially.
Yeah, he was totally captured by the idea of Holden and turned over his electrical business to his family and committed himself 100% to getting this place up and running. And in terms of just the physical wrestling of this place from the decay of just a few years as a ghost town. I mean, he was almost, you know, willed it into existence at some points.
And then would you say a little more about Wilton Bergstrand and how what that was all about?
Established the Forerunners groups, right, that came in, large groups of young people.
Both 61 and 62, he and his wife led in the work camp groups that did the actual cleanup. And it wasn't just the physical work, they also brought in programming for those work camp groups so that there were faculty people that did Bible and nature and other things.
I think he brought some shape to what our program is now, right, too, in that context.
And it was
the day, how the day is shaped.
Yep. And as I say, he was so important in the larger relationships to the greater church, youth organization, but also the larger church bodies. And it wasn't universally accepted among the Lutheran church organizations that Holden was such a great idea. And it took a lot of salesmanship within the synodical structures to, you know, eke out a place for Holden. In those years and after, Holden was unique in that this was a place where all Lutherans came together, and it was one of the few projects that involved all the Lutheran synodical groups. And there was a lot of tension in the early years about communing together, and particularly with the Missouri Synod, and this was one of the first places where communion was celebrated among all the Lutheran groups. Think establishing that was so instrumental.
Yeah, and the board was actually distributed among the various Lutheran groups very specifically, as I recall. Do you want to add something in there, Janet? Okay. Okay. Well, the next name on the list is Wes. And we've really gone through that history. Is anybody who has a burning desire to say something about Wes's influence? If we have time at the end, I can tell you how we did the Dead and Dying Soldier twice this summer, both of them quite spectacular. But failing that, maybe we can move on to Werner and talk a little about his influence. And I wonder if I could turn to Christopher for starting us off there.
first met Werner in 1977, where he was my supervisor when I was on volunteer staff, and again in 81, 82, when I returned. And Rick said how he was to fill a lot of different functions. All my initial contact and correspondence and arranging to come in the first place was with Werner. And when I came, we worked with Werner for how long I would stay and what job I would have and so forth. And he was ran the operations as well as the business at that time. But the other thing he did was he was also everyone's turnover file. He had all that in his head. And one of the great things about Werner is that he was here long enough that when you wondered about what worked here and what didn't, or what we did before, how something happened, you could always ask Werner. And he had it all up in his head. He remembered the things that we tried before. Yeah, we tried that 8-9 years ago, and this is why it worked, and this is why it didn't work. And when people would, like still happens, volunteer staff would cycle in and cycle out, sometimes there wasn't any overlap, and we'd have somebody come in who was the plumber who didn't know anything about the village plumbing, but Werner knew it all. So you just went to Werner, and oftentimes he would be the village plumber himself when there wasn't one in between. He'd run the hydro. And I still confer with Werner occasionally. He's still a good resource, a great resource for the village. And sometimes I've said, Werner, what are we going to do? We're just not getting the volunteers we need to keep everything going. So, oh yeah, we've always had that problem. You just have to do it yourself for a while and then somebody will come along. And I think he was here over 20 years.
At least 20 years. He left in 83.
Any other memories about Werner? That's a great summary of what my sense is of Werner was exactly what Christopher said.
Well, they always had, they were very welcoming. Werner was just an easy person to work with. And as I said, when I needed someone to play a role of Cranmer, he was right there. And ultimately, you realize Cranmer gets killed in the process, but Werner survived.
He had a great sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And he was very calm.
He did crazy things.
I think he was also, he led worship sometimes, especially in the winter. I think it's a really good thing to remember that Holden actually did have lay pastors then, or because he celebrated Holy Communion, and he was, well, he led the inter-accessory prayer, we talked about that, but he also helped with these late-night worship services. I think we used to call them laying on of hands or something, but they were like healing services, and Werner really was a lay person who was very active in worship and everything.
It seems to me somebody told me recently that he would occasionally say to a whole work area, let's all quit work now and go to a session for an hour and we'll come back or something. That he would sort of lead, he was instrumental in leading staff into more participation in program when they were able, which was another, it's always been a feature of this place one way or another.
And also that Werner was instrumental in evolving winter community here. We began with just a skeleton crew to keep the place going through the winter, and Werner started developing more and more of a winter community with programmatic elements, and then establishing the group home for boys as an early winter program. And it started in the mid-60s with just a few people and grew so that by the early 70s, winter program was an important feature of the village, and then the lifestyle enrichment program was started as a still more formalized kind of winter programming for post-high school kids that led by John Grauber, son-in-law of Carol Hinderly.
I met Werner in 1980, and my impression of him, I worked with him then for 3 years, was that was a time, or he was a person that seeded all kinds of crazy ideas, like the water wheel, like the Jerusalem artichokes, like the trout pond, that he saw other people that wanted to try things, and he helped make those sorts of things happen as kind of an educational opportunity as well as an alternative way of doing things around here. I'm sure there are other people involved with that, but it seemed like Werner was kind of one of these people that nurtured those sorts of ideas to happen here. Maybe you know better about that.
And Rick, this afternoon at 1 or 1:30, 1 o'clock, we're going to be talking more about the various projects that have gone on historically here.
Yeah, sort of the physical foundations of the place and projects and activities that went on through those years.
Beanie and Gertrude, you know, Gertrude was here this summer for 3 weeks and it was wonderful to see her. Janet, do you want to say a few things?
Well, I met both of them in 1980 again. That's the first time I came here. I feel like a kid around here, even though I've been around for 10 years. And at that time, that was kind of towards the end of Beanie's time at Holden Village. He died in 1984 spring. But clearly, Gertrude and Beanie were people who, as most of you probably know, were really founders and people that carried through even hard times over the years with music and for Beanie, certainly, and the Beanie's things are still to this day, 16 years after his death, people want to have the Beanie things. They, even though there's never going to be another Beanie to be able to lead them the way he led them. And the Carillon is another thing that remains a real memory of Beanie's time singing, playing Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, or I Get Sunshine on My Shoulders, or what's the rain one? He used to tell the weather. You're dead when the
face.
What's that?
Raindrops keep falling on my face.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Raindrops keep falling on my face. If you're in bed and the Carillon went on, you knew what the weather was that day. Gertrude, as I understand it, really started the craft program, and she talks about doing it in the basement of Shelley 7, where she and Beanie and their family stayed many of the summers that they came. Gertrude said this summer, she's been here every summer since 1963, except the summer that Beanie died. Mm-hmm. So she's 87 now, and did just fine getting around here still, but she's getting smaller and smaller.
So she was the village hostess.
Yeah, then she became the village hostess and did the Sunday morning teas, and she'd have marguerites, which are these little crackers that with very simple things. She always tried to keep things simple and use the resources that we had here.
And she did the
for
flowers.
Craft things, yeah, and the flowers. So. And Gertrude has served on the Holden Board as an advisory member for several years now. She just decided that this would be her last year and did not ask to be considered for re-election at this point. So, strong history there.
And she would do those nature walks.
And the We Nature Trail. Yeah. We have a video of Gertrude doing that probably about 9 or 10 years ago. Down behind here. She always had wonderful stories that she connected to, some biblical reflection that she looked at a plant and she could see God in the plants. Mm-hmm. It was great.
Well, let's take a moment and think about Rudy and Doris.
Rudy came as part of this summer teaching faculty to teach geology and then was captivated by the mine and the history of that and trying to preserve that history. And you know, he had such a delightful way about him and such a sparkle to his eyes when he talked about the mine and the mine history and led his mine hikes.
He's also a great hiker. We'd be hiking in from across the other side of the Cascades and be up around Cloudy Pass, and you'd see him just sort of hiking up and hiking back to fish and catch some trout. And he'd say, "Oh, I just came up just for today. I'll swing back now."
amazing. Mm-hmm.
Well into his 70s, he could still climb. He could go directly from Lake Chelan up to Donkey without getting short of breath at all. Just like a ship sort of going up that mountain. Doesn't pause.
His last time in the village was when he was 87. For Christmas, he brought his whole family. Doris had passed away, and we had a lot of snow that year. That was the biggest, and we had ended up that winter, we had 500 inches. So by Christmas, we'd had a lot of snow. And he got off the bombardiers out here, and he went up to the Portal Museum through the snow, hiked there at 87. It was short, and it was at that time, though, short while here, that he had his first stroke that, then 11 months later, he passed away. But he hiked that right up there through that deep snow.
Well, obviously there's much to be said about them, but I sort of wanted to get us into Fritz Norstedt and John and Mary, just to think about how things began to change, and that change in leadership from a kind of stable faculty in the early years, where Carol and Mary would bring the same people back year after year, and there were some very high profile, wonderful teachers that just became committed to this place. I remember in one of the first years of Holden Village, Carol Hinderly coming to my home and trying to persuade my father, who was a Lutheran choir director, to come to Holden and make it a part of our family's life. And they had been classmates at St. Olaf, and they were good friends. And Carol talked about the education of the laity and how my dad could teach people to make better choirs in their home congregations. My dad had a big family and was interested in making money in the summer, so he didn't do it. But that kind of way of thinking about the program here, I think, began to change under changing leadership. And Christopher, I wonder if you'd say a little bit about Fritz and how you were here during that year, how that felt to go through that change, what his contributions were.
Fritz was the interim director, and Carol nearly left before John Schrant came, and I was here that winter. And I've often thought of Fritz this last year when Warren Selveson was interim director. I think they have a lot in common. And an interim year, it usually isn't a year to come in and make a lot of big changes, but it's a year to hold things together in a time of healing. And that was really what was needed that year. And Fritz had a wonderful way of helping that healing process happen. He was a very generous person. He loved to talk to people. He always had lots of time for me. As a 22-year-old young volunteer at that time, I felt like I could go to him anytime. And he loved to entertain and have people over. And I think he was a very important part of that transition between that difficult departure of Carol Hinderly and the new administration coming in that next spring.
When you say difficult, is it because it was so sad to have him go, or was there something about it?
I wasn't here when Carol left. He had left just prior to my arrival. But maybe somebody else can speak to that. I'm sure there was some of both. There were people that were very sad to see him go.
Did the program pretty much remain the same that next year then, or was there any change in emphasis there, do you think?
No, I think still in that summer of 77, a lot of the old standbys from the Hinderly years were in residence. Mm-hmm. A lot of these people we saw slides, so mm-hmm. We're here then.
Anybody else want to comment about Fritz's time here, or Fritz? He'd been on the teaching staff, you know, for years when he became interim director.
Wasn't he interested in the stars?
Oh, that's right, he had a telescope, yes. Mm-hmm. He and Karen Sturm both were very interested in therapy. Yeah.
And photography. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And he had a dog.
Yes, that came got up in the garbage all the time.
Uh-huh. Which, reminds me of Werner's dog.
Oh, yeah.
I think I almost got pushed down the talus slope there going up to Copper Creek by that big dog. It's a little dangerous having him along on a trail with you.
It's
Well, Gertrude Norsen was also really hospitable and wonderful, especially with the kids. I remember, and she's still alive, living in Leavenworth, with another dog, same breed though, and same name. I forget what they're all called, the same name. Anyway, it's this brown, short-haired kind of dog. But anyway, And she would invite the kids at the village over to her house and stuff. They were just wonderful that year.
And then John and Mary came, and lots of people know about the Schrammers. Barbara, would you characterize a little bit of what you think is a change of when John and Mary got here?
Well, they had already been on teaching staff in 1974, and that was when I first heard about the country of Namibia, for example, in southern Africa. So under Carol's leadership, there was a lot of attention to social issues and justice and political stuff. I think John and Mary brought that, and it was a really great time. They also brought in Dan Erlander, which, you know, was one of the major accomplishments to be the resource packet editor and to share Holden with the broader public. Those were heyday years in some ways, finally enough money and a real excitement. I don't know, Janet would know more about the
John, my experience of Holden began when I began here. John and Mary were here, and clearly Mary was not called to be director, but clearly they were a team as directors, as were Carol and Mary Hinderly, I think. John, I know he talks about, when I talk to him about some of the trials that I've faced in the last 6 years, he'll say, but I had Werner, and now I have Christopher. So, but John, they clearly did bring a social justice aspect to the village, and a real strength in that, and a real commitment to those sorts of things. One of the hard things that John had to do during those times was to look at this deeply rooted, strong group of people who are connected to the village and who had been for 15 or more years, perhaps. And he made some changes in personnel. And as Rick pointed out in the slides, the first summer teaching staff coordinator who lived outside the village was called at that point, and while Bowman, through John and Mary. And so they started making some sort of staffing sorts of changes, and that was very difficult, I think, for people who had thought they might live the rest of their lives here. And there was a movement at that point for people to really say, you probably only can live here a couple of years at most to be on staff, to give so many other people a chance to kind of be part of the program. So there was kind of a freshening up and a new kind of time of not only of people, but of ideas and movement into a new decade, I guess, at that point. Clearly a commitment to education. Mary wrote Gifts of Grace while she lived here, a little book published by Augsburg that sold lots and lots. It's out of print right now. Holden Village is hoping to reprint that now in the next couple of years, make it available. So.
I was just, you're saying it was interesting how his philosophy so much was a change of personnel, but it was also a change of the visitors. We had come up here for 10 straight years, and as I was going through the registration area, and I just was talking, I said, well, we've been up here for 10 straight years. And she looked at me and she says, well, we really don't want people to do that because we want other people to come. And so we really don't want you to come up here every year. And I went, that's fine. We didn't come back for 20 years.
Wow.
I've never heard that before. I did hear that, you know, at those times there were lots of people who wanted to come. And I think it was some efforts made to try to make it possible for more people to experience Holden, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure. It was just, it wasn't exactly what I had expected and what we had over the Carol Hinderly years.
Well, I think that's true, and probably in the Carol. When somebody said something about, oh, Ruth, you said something about Beanie's things, we didn't have to rush after meals, I had the impression that there only was one.
There was only one session, and it was really the occasions when there was a second session was rather distressing. And so it was
the gym, the hotel, one meal made it a lot easier on the white tribe.
Sure.
Of course, the population was less.
Yeah, yeah.
Did the food diet change during John and Mary Schramm's time too? Because we went to more of the vegetarian type.
I don't know if it was then or Paul Hinderly kind of made some changes in the kitchen too, and I don't know where that.
You got the impression.
I think it was with the Schramms that you had fewer desserts and maybe a continuing a trend that already had started. Mm-hmm. But the food has always been a really high priority for Holden.
I think the hunger awareness meal started in the winter community during the Schramm time or towards the end of, in the late 70s. And then in the mid 80s, it kind of spilled over to be all year round.
But during the Carol Hinderly years, the food was much more, my hearing of it at least, is the kind of festival meals with lots of meat and lots of
bakery.
First time we came in, we got off the bus and he said, okay, today it's fried chicken and apple pie for dessert. And that was our first time we came to Holden, that was with Carol Hinderly's years, so it was quite a different concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think it would have been the acceptable. Been it as possible for vegetarians to have come during those years and gotten a good diet.
Of course, the culture has changed.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Many places.
Well, I feel bad to have rushed us through this, and I don't know that there's another way to do it, but it seems like we could relax and tell stories endlessly and have a lot of fun doing it. But thanks for coming and thanks for sharing the stories you've shared.
Can I say what Tracy asked that I come and tell you a little bit about the development of something that happened. We were here in 69-70 during plays.
Why don't you say your name?
I'm Ruth Doherty. Did Man for All Seasons, I already mentioned that with Werner Jensen, and we did it on Lodge 3. The stage is really small for doing a play, so decided to do it outside of Lodge 3. Using both levels, entrances from upstairs and entrances from the door there in Lodge 3. Well, at that time, I didn't know this until dress rehearsal, that those kids that went out the door on the first level and came in on the second level had to go up a ladder in the back. The ladder was a fire escape, and they didn't tell me this until dress rehearsal. And they did this with aplomb, you know, up and down the ladder as it came. But I think we would have probably planned it a little different if I had known.
No stairway
in the back. And there have been so many things that have happened in the process that you'll probably talk about tomorrow later, but I'm kind of amazed sometimes when I think of what was taken for granted. And that was a real taking for granted, and a lot of things, good things have happened.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Come to Rick's session at 1 and we'll talk more about the physical plant and talk about some of the wonderful projects, both successful and not so successful, that have gone on through the years.
Could I ask you, in the pictures in the background was the old blue bus. We were walking up there, and of course it has no engine nowadays, and it's full of bags of something. What is stored in that?
That's the materials that have to be hauled out to a landfill. They're stored in there till the bus fills up, and then it gets loaded on a truck to be barged out.
And how often does that happen? How long does it take to fill it up?
Once a month in the summer, and once every winter.
And so how many people stay here during the winter nowadays?
60 to 70.
Does it go after Christmas? Don't you think that's great though? They never have to buy any dumpsters. We thought up that idea. Oh, parse the bus is a dumpster.